Hey folks, we've got a new workshop coming up that I'm really excited about. This is a topic that I don't talk about a whole lot on the show. This is September 23rd at noon, and this is going to be about debt. I find a lot of the teaching on this particular topic is not so great. It's very one-sided, or it misses a lot of detail that I think really needs to be addressed. You know, how do we get into it? We talk about that a little bit, but there, you know, some people say, well, you'd get into it because of lack of discipline. Well, no, it often is more nuanced than that. We're going to be talking about how do you get out of it? How do we change our mindset regarding it in lots of different ways? Some of the best advice I was ever given was like over 30 years ago that helped me a lot. And I'm going to share some of that in the workshop. And we're going to talk about the little known facts and myths about credit scores. A lot of people don't understand how credit scores work. So I'm going to get into that. And people ask about, now, Paul, what about 30 versus 15-year mortgages? And people think you always do one or the other. And that's more nuanced as well. And I'm going to be talking about strategically when to use one versus another and some of the thinking regarding that. So it's going to be a great workshop. I'm really excited about it. September 23rd at noon. Join us, and you can click in the show notes to sign up or go to paulwinkler.com/debt. We'll see you there.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
And welcome. This is the Investor Coaching Show. I am Paul Winkler. Talking that world of money, financial planning, retirement planning. Interesting. It's actually watching a video, reading an article, and I thought, ooh, these two go together. It's like that commercial where the guy's walking with chocolate and the other person's walking with peanut butter. They run into each other. Ooh, we've got something here. Putting two things together sometimes, it's just yeah, you can come up with some pretty good results when you put two things together sometimes, right? So this article was about, it was about mistakes that rich people are always making with their money. Now, yeah, I don't know. Sometimes when I see this is always happening, or this never happens, you know, extreme thinking. Extreme thinking is always bad. I could make that point, right? So, nobody always does anything, right? Yeah, sometimes there are exceptions to the rules, and that's what you got to find. But anyway, I might have reworded it, three mistakes that rich people often make with money, and according to planners. Having money and managing it don't always go hand in hand. Now, I'm going to actually combine this with something I saw with Malcolm Gladwell. He's a good writer, phenomenal writer. Actually, he came out to a conference I was at a few years ago. Really interesting guy. He's got some great books out there, Tipping Point, and you know, there's all this whole book on outliers and fascinating stuff that he's done work on. You know, just really interesting reading. But anyway, he had a video that he put out, and it was on another book that he had written. It was on talking to strangers. Another really super interesting book. But he was talking about the thing that we should know about people that we probably don't know. You know, things that we ought to know that we don't often know about people. And I thought, oh, I'm going to combine it with this one because this is really, really interesting. Rich people typically make some mistakes a lot of times in areas that you wouldn't think that they would make mistakes. And number one, he said, this article was talking about how... this is in Business Insider, and there are three common mistakes. One is spending way too much. I said, between lavish homes, luxury cars, pricey country club memberships. Now, this isn't always the case, obviously, because if you read The Millionaire Next Door, they actually show that the typical vehicle or most driven vehicle by millionaires isn't a lavish luxury car. It's actually back when they wrote it, it was a Ford F-150 pickup. But, you know, if you look at wealthy people, a lot of times they don't drive really fancy vehicles. People that drive really fancy vehicles are often broke, and they have a lot of debt, and they don't actually have a whole lot of money. But, you know, this is the typical vision that we have of wealthy people, is that they live in these gorgeous, huge homes, and they drive the most beautiful cars, and they are in these wonderful country clubs. But, you know, this is why a lot of times rich people end up not so rich, is because they do these types of things. And I would agree with that point right here. Now, there are endless things that could tempt you to spend your cash, the writer says. And apparently, interviewing maybe a financial advisor friend for this particular article, but this person keeps getting referred to in here, and it says the problem is it gets even bigger when they think they have enough money to retire early. Reminds me of that FIRE movement. You know, financially independent, retire early, I think is what it stands for. And the idea you can build up a ton of money and then you can retire. And then you've got, you know, maybe you retire when you're 35 and you might have 60 years ahead of you to make sure the money lasts. And that could be kind of dangerous, especially if you've gotten an advanced degree in something and 20 years later you realize maybe I don't have enough to retire and maybe my investment prowess wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. And now you have to go back to work, but now you're 55 years old, you retired when you were 35, and now you don't have any of the knowledge that you had when you were 35, and you have to go back to school, and yeah, that can be a real mess. But, you know, this is something that they're talking about here. You could have this happen where you just don't realize you needed more money than you thought you were going to need. So that's one mistake. And this financial advisor says, Adam is the person's name, had seen high-earning professionals blow through their cash during retirement only to come to the advisor when they've gotten down to their last $1,000. And then they realize, oh, what do I do? And I've had that experience where people come in and they go, hey, Paul, this is what happened to me. And I go, I don't know how to help you now. A friend of mine tells a story that's really, really, he was talking about when he was working with this one guy, it was a physician, and this guy goes, you know, I'm good. I've got this. I'm a sophisticated investor, but you know, I would love it if you'd help my daughter. And she says she has like $250,000 and she just needs some help on making sure that she doesn't make a mistake with her money. This guy was like a brain surgeon or something. It was a neurosurgeon. I know he had to work with his hands. I can't remember exactly what he did. But he goes on his merry way. And this is back in, I think it was in the early 2000s that this happened. In late 90s, the conversation took place. But in the early 2000s, this happened. And you can kind of know where this is going. Well, his daughter comes, works with the advisor, a friend of mine that's very academically based, like, you know, like we are. And she does fine. And then what ends up happening was, she comes years later and goes, hey, could you help my dad? Do you remember him? Oh, yeah, I remember him. So, yeah, well, bring him in. And comes in, and apparently what happened, this guy, his whole net worth was just ground to a pulp because it didn't get invested properly. Ended up in the tech bubble, and that whole thing, you know, just fell apart. A lot like today, you know, you see these big tech companies are rocking it, and people are overweighted in large U.S. companies, and they're thinking, hey, I'm bulletproof, and well, they didn't come to their senses back in the late 90s, many people, and ended up losing 80% of their money. And that's exactly what happened to this guy. Lost pretty much everything, comes back and says, hey, you know, and his hand's shaking, right? Well, here's a guy's a neurosurgeon. Your hand shaking is not a real good idea. You know, so you can't stay steady and do anything that you used to do, and yet he's run out of money. And it was just a really, really sad story. So this type of stuff happens. Well, that's one thing. Okay, so you spend too much, or, you know, I could add to that, you just kind of think you're better at investing than you really are. You think you know more than you actually do. That was one. The next one was not having a family mission statement. And this was, you know, where people don't really know what their money is for. And, you know, I like that. I thought that was a really good point in this article, because that's one of the things that we do with people first off. Is we'll bring them through, hey, what's your purpose for your money? And there are questions I like to ask. You know, for example, I'll have people come up with a bucket list, and there are ways of asking that question, but, you know, actually attaching a value to those things, you know, because you may want a certain thing, but the reason you want it is actually more important than the thing you want. And I'll give you a simple example. let's say I want a cottage in New Hampshire or something like that. And you go, well, if I get down into why do I want that cottage in New Hampshire, maybe it's to connect with family members, have a vacation place to go to. Well, what's your real purpose? Your real purpose is connection with family members, right? It's not necessarily the thing. It's not the house or the cottage in this particular case. It's what that represents and what it allows and the connection that it allows. So, you know, a lot of the things that we are really driven by have absolutely nothing to do with material goods, right? There's something else behind it. And a lot of times that's a really important thing to actually establish because we may be blowing money on things that really don't have any real purpose and they're not really meaningful to us. What if we could just redirect our efforts to things that are really meaningful, and then we would have a more sustainable retirement and we would lessen the opportunity for ourselves to run out of money and run our net worth into the ground? Wouldn't that be a kind of a cool thing? So, you know, I think that is really, really true. We got to come up with a purpose and really think about what is our mission? What is it we really want to accomplish as a family? And a lot of times we don't do those types of things, don't go through those exercises, maybe because we don't know how to. This one thing, what's quite possible, you know, maybe not having a background. A lot of times it takes somebody to facilitate that. But it may be just, don't even think about that kind of stuff. And the third one was trusting too easily was what they wrote in the article. It says, you know, people that come in as sudden wealth, such as inheritance, lottery win, or a legal settlement, or sudden fame, or something like that, they're not trained to manage money. You know, they never grew up with it, or maybe they haven't been around it, or it's so sudden that quite often they end up vulnerable to bad investment opportunities. And I've seen this many, many times with people. I remember one guy coming in one day, and he goes, "You're my last hope." And I was like, oh boy, what? And he told me what had happened. He had a bunch of money and it ended up becoming a whole lot of nothing. I ended up being ground to a pulp because it was a really bad investment opportunity, but it sounded really great. I've had this many times in my career. You know, there are several instances that come to my mind that were really sad. And you know, it's one of those things you think everything makes so much sense when you hear the sales pitch. Oh yeah, this sounds really, really great. And then when you really dig down, it isn't so great. And then you can't make up for the lost time is really what it gets down to. Because it may be 20 years before things fall apart. And then where are you? And a lot of times people do blindly trust. And I've often said that. Don't blindly trust. Don't do it. You need to understand. You need to be a partner in this process. You know, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? What are the expectations? How does this work? Why does it work? I'm really big on why. You know, I don't tell me to just do something. I want to know why I'm doing it. Because if I know why I'm doing it, I'm more likely to do it. Very, very important. I'm more likely to carry through. I'm more likely not to get sidetracked or pulled off if I know why I'm doing something and if it makes logical sense. Because let's face it, markets go up and they go down. When they go up, everything's hunky-dory. Everything's great. When they go down, that's when I start to second-guess myself. And that's the worst time, quite often, to second-guess yourself, is when markets have gone down or what you're investing in has gone down in value. Because then you go and make a change, and then when you make that change, you lock in the loss and you're sunk, right? So it's really, really important to understand this. So we talk about blindly trusting. It says, you know, professional athletes are most vulnerable to this. You know, because they come into money. I remember one guy, you know, he was actually a football player going, well, I got two financial advisors. And they said, well, why do you have two? Well, you know, one's watching the other. And I'm like, what if they're both kind of just giving each other the pass and they're not really watching each other? You know, they don't want, one doesn't want to call out the other. And you may be having mismanagement on both ends is what I'm thinking. And knowing the situation as I did, I knew that was the case. So it's, you know, it can be something where you think you've, you know, dotted your I and crossed your T by having two different people watching things, and they're both messing up in just different ways. And you'd go, wow. So why is it that we trust? Well, this is where the video comes in. So Malcolm Gladwell's talking about, you know, talking to strangers, writes this book, and he says, you know, I'm going to tell you a story from this. And it was really, he says, I'm really into like CIA, you know, and I'm really into, the intrigue of the intelligence community and deep government, deep state type stuff. And he says, there's this guy. And he was reading something about this guy, and it was referred to as the mountain climber. And the mountain climber was this top CIA operative, right? And this guy could speak Russian better than a lot of Russians could speak Russian. And this guy was really, really good. And the Russian government thought this guy is the epitome of unbelievably good operative. And what happens is he gets promoted by the U.S. government to actually work in Havana, which, you know, promoted to Havana. Well, you know, Havana is, as he said, the back door to a lot of America's enemies because it's so close, right? You know, so they get in there and they're really close to the United States. So a lot of times people will go there. So this guy's promoted to the top guy in Havana, and he gets this call. And he gets this call that he's supposed to fly to Frankfurt, and he's supposed to meet this guy named Florentino. And Florentino is his equivalent in Havana at the time. He is the top guy in Havana. And he gets this call to go meet with this guy. And this guy had, you know, this Florentino guy was disillusioned. And he was disillusioned with Castro. So he decides he's out of Cuba. He's leaving Cuba. He's defecting. And he has a story to tell. Well, his thing is that he has a story to tell, and the U.S. government's like, yeah, I want to hear this guy's story. Well, he will only tell it to this guy who is referred to as the mountain climber. And he says, you know, well, he meets with this guy, and he says, well, tell me something. The mountain climber goes to this other guy from Cuba. Tell me something to verify who you are, the veracity of your story. Who are you? And prove to me that you're legitimate, basically. And he goes, well, you know, you got this guy by the name of Juan that you worked with. And he says, yeah. And he says, well, you know, he took pictures of documents of, you know, Castro's documents. And he'd said, oh, well, he was a great source for me. Yeah. And he says, well, how do you know him? And he goes, well, he worked for us. He was a double agent. And this guy's like, what? Are you kidding me? And he goes, oh, I'm not done yet. And then he goes, oh, there was this guy named Pedro. And he, you know, would tell you all about the military capabilities of Cuba. What? And, you know, he's having a fit. Oh, my goodness. How do you know him? Well, he was working for us. He was a double agent. And all these people that he'd worked with, his entire network pretty much in Cuba, the U.S. guy, the mountain climber, comes to find out that these are all operatives and they're all working for the other side, right? And he goes, well, how do you get deceived like this? How is it? And who is it that gets deceived? And he goes, you know, we often think that the person that gets deceived is this little old lady in the middle of nowhere that gets a, you know, call that that somebody's come into $3 million and it has her name on it or something like that. And she falls for it and pulls out her checkbook or whatever. And, you know, the reality of it is, no, a lot of times it's people you'd never dream of being naive that get fooled. They're not stupid. They tend to be very, very sophisticated. And he used the example of Bernie Madoff, as I've used here on the radio show many times. He didn't go out and get little old people that had no money. He went after people that had a lot of money, hedge fund managers. And that's who he took advantage of. And he didn't necessarily have, you know, the top accountant in the whole world. The guy was from, you know, some little area in New York, a backwoods area in New York. And you never dream that a person like this had actually put together this whole thing, and he actually didn't get caught. He turned himself in, you know? So what often happens is we just trust people. And he says, you know, the thing is we often trust and we think, oh, well, wouldn't we have evolved out of this? And he makes a really interesting point about how adaptive trust can actually be. It's evolutionary. And he says, you know, we tend to be bad at detecting deception. And why? He says, well, you know, let's say if you look at, you know, who you would choose, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint over, you know, thousands of years, who would you actually choose as a spouse? Someone that's loving, trusting, and open? Or would you go and choose somebody that's is dealing with paranoia and suspicion? No, you choose the person that's loving and trusting, right? That's who you would actually. So what happens is it has been something that has been very good from an adaptive standpoint, that we do tend to gravitate toward people who are loving and trusting, and therefore that has been what has been passed on. And, you know, evil geniuses, I guess there are a few of them out there. There are some. But a lot of times what happens is that when you look at the investment industry, we don't often find that there are people out there that are just waiting to take advantage of you. But a lot of times they themselves are deceived. You know, I've talked about being a broker for so many years. I was a broker for many, many years. And, you know, going to the broker-dealer conferences, they were trying to get us to sell real estate investment trusts to people. Permanent life insurance as an investment was another thing that, you know, they would come in and they would say, hey, you know, you guys really need to sell low-income housing credits for people. And they all really, really sounded great. Annuities, indexed annuities, gold and commodities, investments based on demographic trends was one of the things that I've talked about here on this show. And, you know, back when the big downturn in the economy happened in 2008, there were some of the most prominent financial people on TV who shall remain nameless, although I'd be tempted to say names. I'm not going to. They were telling people, please, if you need your money back in the next, you know, 5 years, please get it out of the stock market. Well, that was one of some of the worst advice ever. But did they probably believe that that was really a good idea? I sincerely do believe that they did think it was a good idea. And the reason why? Because a lot of times people get information and you don't know where they got in the information. So I think it's so important to understand investing. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? You know, what are the expectations? How do markets work? Where do returns come? You don't have to know everything, but there are certain things that if you don't understand, it is really easy to be taken advantage of by somebody that may not be trying to take advantage of you. They may actually think that what they're telling you is really in your best interest, but maybe they are actually misled. Maybe they are blindly trusting. I've known a lot of people in the investment industry. They work for big investment firms, and they just parrot back whatever they were taught by their management, believing it actually made sense. And you know, like, for example, I worked for a big insurance company, and what they would talk about all the time is, you know, this is a great look at this tax benefit of this life insurance policy, and, you know, look at how much money you can have in so many years, and they'd have these wonderful illustrations that didn't work out. They didn't work out, but at the time they were sold, they looked so good. But, you know, reality of it was people that were out there peddling this were blindly trusting the company and the leadership in the company that may or may not have necessarily had the best interest of them and their customers in mind. And that's all it takes. So blind trust, why do we fall for things? Not necessarily because we're dumb, but so often it's because we actually have this trust that has been adaptive for centuries and centuries. And it's actually something that's really good, but you gotta really be careful because blindly trusting can get you into so much trouble. Understanding, education, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? And once I understand those things, I can be a much more successful investor. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.